light against our being is the light of attention. And when we are able to provide the light of attention to ourselves, the light of attention to others, it both enhances our own heartfulness, our own presentness, and it creates a feeling of safety and relaxation and ease and open-heartedness for whoever we share our light with, that we actually attend to. I think of attention, and again, this may sound very general, but I think of attention as being literally a cause of love. I'm sure, I know that I've led a lot of retreats with Heather Martin, and both of us share this one phrase that that attention brings affection. And there is an element of our meditation practice that's something that's very, for each of us, we are trainable. One of the beautiful things about the nature of our mind is it can be strengthened, it can be opened, it can be trained to apply, to shine a bright light on ourselves and on our world. And the practice employs qualities that are intrinsic to us, that you could say they're innate qualities. One of those qualities, and it may seem so simple that it's so easy to overlook, is that I can take a very undifferentiated, just kind of a natural, some would call it primordial awareness, you know, just the fact that I'm aware. I can take that awareness, and I'm noticing Brock sitting in front, I can take that awareness and through volition, I can gather that attention to see Brock. And if I gather the attention and I sustain that attention, so two qualities right off the bat, what are called in the Pali language, vitaka and vichara. Gathering or aiming and sustaining. Those two qualities, if I bring those to bear on anything that I connect with and sustain that connection, after a short period, I will start to feel, if I do that, I will start to feel intensely interested in what I'm paying attention to. Now, I could be doing something very, you know, like washing the dishes or chopping vegetables, but especially when it comes to other people, if I aim and sustain, it's all using the natural qualities of my mind, I will start to feel an intense interest. I will start to feel a kind of comfort, a kind of intimacy, and I will start to feel a sense of one-pointedness where my mind doesn't move. I don't want to be somewhere else. And this, you could say, this quality of being gathered, sustained, interested, comfortable, and what we call one-pointed, ekagata, to me is the quality of love. And it's the quality that each of us longs for. We long to be experienced this way by others, and we long to be able to do that, to be able to have our attention stay in the location that we're actually living. Now, why that seems so natural, but it's not something that we do. Our mind tends to be, even though it is intrinsically has all these qualities, our mind tends to be untrained, scattered. Our bodies tend to be tight, and we tend to spend a lot of time in discursive thinking. And the simple shift from that just reactive, conditioned habit of mind to intentionally giving ourselves the gift of coalescing some of the helpful qualities that are already in our mind, actually putting them to practice, it brings gladness, brings happiness, is a gift to ourselves and And as when it, in regard to being with another, it's a huge gift. It's like, just for me to take you in, for you to take me in, and look to remember together that we're all in the room, that we're not, we are nowhere but here. That there is no other place than here. Isn't that amazing? This, our whole life, I often say that your whole life has come to this. To me, that's wild, because everything that's happened before is really gone. And the only way we know it is in our imagination, and the only way we have imagination is here. And anything that is has not yet occurred is also not real, it's imagined. And that imagining of what could be, should be, will be, it's right here. So there's only this. And to orient myself to what always already is a huge gift, because it's the only life that any of us has. In truth. I mean, we have our personal story and our histories and our families. That's it's fantastic. But where do we call upon? Where do we experience that? How can we really feel the effect of our life and our history? We can only feel it in real time. Everything else is imaginary anyway. So what a gift to actually inhabit the only life that you have and the only place that you actually have it. So this attention brings affection to wherever I am and wherever you are. That's a big gift of awakening. I was having lunch with Brock today. We had, where was the, at some little,
Roost.
It was very country, very, very down home, really felt like I was in Wisconsin. I don't know how many of you have been to the upper Midwest, but there's a kind of down home feeling. Anyway, we were, I think it was when we were having lunch, I was recalling a recent conversation with my daughter, a 13-year-old daughter who I would say at 13, she doesn't exactly listen to me that well. Like my mother describes my sister at 13. She says she closed the door at 13 and didn't come out until 18. Anyway, my daughter and I were having breakfast together, and I was having one of those moments where, for a change, I was present. And I just started carrying on a little conversation, something that I talk to people about all the time, but I don't talk to her so much because I don't want to impose any kind of dharma or teachings. I want her to, if she's going to get it by osmosis, or because the worst thing that I can do is try to enroll her, because she'll run the other way. I know that already. But this time I couldn't resist. I said, notice, you know, we had beautiful fruit in front of us, and we had pancakes or French toast or something like that, and juice. And I said, just notice what's sitting here on the plate. And kind of look around and notice this beautiful space that you're sitting in, the kitchen, living room, it's kind of open area. And I said, notice what you're hearing. And then I said, notice that what it is that's noticing. And notice how whatever it is that's noticing is always peaceful. It's always quiet. And when you're actually noticing, no matter if you're actually noticing anything, you are mingling, I didn't use these words, but you are mingling peace with whatever you're noticing. the noticing is always peaceful. And her lights went on for the first time. She didn't say anything, but I could tell that she, for once, she was actually intrigued by what I was saying, and I could see her examining every experience and noticing that the noticing was really peaceful. And what a gift. What a gift, not to her, but what a gift for any of us, and of you, of anyone who realizes that the peace, which seems to be the hidden aim in everything that we do, relief, peace, that peace is so close, so accessible, in some way independent of circumstances. In other words, unconditioned, doesn't depend on conditions. The very nature of the mind that knows, the nature of your mind, is peace. Not to be found anywhere else, but through the awareness through which you're perceiving. And to me, this seems to be one of the great gifts, because so much of the preoccupation of our mind is in seeking peace, is in looking for that secret sauce or that secret cause for us to finally, once and for all, be able to say, ah, I've arrived. And to know that this peace, this arrival, exists as the very natural state of your own heart and mind, it's a gift. It's a relief. So I hope my daughter remembers somewhere along the line. But even those who have practiced a little bit forget. We have, I would say, that we have a lot more conditioning of going out of ourselves in search, of going out into the imagined future or into the imagined past, the good old days, for our sense of relief. And are much more practiced at being in a state of waiting, of hoping, of, I call it, state of suspended happiness, associating relief with some place that we will get to, some accomplishment, some problem that will be solved, some notion that something can make me happier than I am. That hasn't happened yet. Any of you ever have that? So when I said secret teaching before, you know, it sometimes this, what could be called, and what they do call in the in Tibetan tradition, natural great peace. It's sometimes called an open secret. It's open for anyone to see, but we miss it. And we miss it because it's so close. We miss it, as they say, it's so close, it's so wondrous, it's so vast, it's invisible in a way. And it's so easy. Can't believe that we have to just keep attuning to that simple quietness of being in a state of lucid awareness, of being aware. So it seems that if one nurtures this simple quality of noticing what you're doing when you're doing it, noticing when you're walking, noticing when you're eating, noticing when you're looking at someone or talking, and you are aware of, you could say aware of being aware, that this quality of peace just grows. And that peacefulness is such a gift to others. You become, because of your riches, the richness of your own natural state. I always think of Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, "You who are the richest person on earth, who've been going around begging for a living, stop being the destitute child. Come home, reclaim your heritage." But your riches become a refuge for others. You become a stable refuge, a safe place. The gift of this openness and attention is also the gift of all the qualities that flow from attention, of loving kindness, of intelligence, of intuition, of creativity. Everything flows from our consciousness. And to the degree that you mingle with your own inner riches, that you actually train your attention, as the Buddha put it, there is nothing more conducive to misery than an untrained mind. And nothing more conducive for happiness and well-being than a well-cultivated, well-trained mind. So if you mingle with the riches that live in you, tremendous gift to the people who have to live around you every day. And I think of the gift of awakening. I think of the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, if you put it in Buddha Dharma terms. There's three basic parts to the Noble Eightfold Path. There's the first basket, the first part of the Eightfold Path is, we call it action. So there's the purification of our livelihood, right? It includes right livelihood. So we stop causing harm with our livelihood, start doing whatever we do for our work in a non-harming way, in a loving way, in a wakeful way, in a wise way. So it includes wise speech. So we stop causing ourselves and each other harm with our speech. What a gift. And then the last part is wise action. That essentially means do no harm. It means don't, and that also includes the wise speech, but not, you don't take what's not offered. You don't steal. You don't exploit in your sensual, sexual relationships. You engage in harmonious relationships. You practice simplicity and renunciation, so you're sensitive to your use of resources. So everything about the purification of our action offers a gift of what the Buddha called the gift of fearlessness, where those who are around you don't have to be afraid of you, because you're not trying to, in your presence with them, just think about it, in the workplace, you're not trying to seek an advantage. You're not driven by some kind of egoic need to be, to improve or to be measuring yourself above, below, or equal to somebody. Your motivation is goodwill, is an appreciation from that place of sensitivity that comes from being aware, that sensitivity that you don't exist apart from the people that you're working with or being with every day. That what you do to another, you do to yourself. Motivated by that understanding of interbeing, you stop causing harm. And then people don't have to be afraid of you. In a sense, the more you're settled into that natural peace, you come across as less needy. And so people don't have to defend themselves around you, so your boundaries tend to be a little bit more respectful. Yeah. Is what I'm saying making any sense? And you yourself get to experience what the Buddha also called the bliss of blamelessness, a joy that comes from engaging in your relationships in a non-harming way, doing no harm. You feel the joy of kindness in your speech, and even your thoughts go along with them. It is hard for our ill will and our judgments and our comparisons to coexist with wakefulness, with that sense of curiosity and interest that comes from a sense of immediacy. You know, the closer I get to you, the more intimate I feel with you in this room tonight. How can I judge you from that place of immediacy? There's no room for it. And this increasingly thins that sense of separating thoughts that we tend to have. That maniacal tendency to compare and judge, putting ourselves above, below, or equal to others. So it begins to loosen what the Buddha described as the fetters of the mind, that the tendencies of mind that tend to keep us spinning in a feeling of dissatisfaction and thirst and search. It allows us to really find a home right where you are. Hopefully you're getting a little feel for this, just being here. So the basket of action, and then the second part of the Eightfold Path, another gift. It includes wise effort, which basically encompasses every aspect of the Eightfold Path. But wise effort means cultivating what's wholesome, helpful. Again, when we do what actions of body, of speech, of mind that are harmless, that we're not causing harm, there's a kind of fragrance of purity that grows. And of course, it's so with the wise effort, the teachings, the suggestion is you cultivate the wholesome and you maintain it. And then you abandon what's unwholesome or not helpful, things that cause harm, and you become so strong of heart and mind that you prevent the unwholesome tendencies of mind to come up. And that, of course, requires a lot of keeping good company too. Nobody does this alone. So then it also includes wise mindfulness, which is really that quality of knowing what it is that's happening, clearly comprehending your present location, your present context, what you're doing, who you're doing it with, being sensitive to the room, so to speak, as well as what's happening at any of your being so attuned to what's entering your different senses. Now, if you're aware of what's entering your eyes or your ears or your nose or your tongue or your body, if you actually have attention arising at the same time as those experiences that you're having, not 5 minutes delayed, which is what happens when we don't train our attention. When it's real time, it does not allow our mind to go down the slippery slope, or the doesn't allow our mind to get into into a virtual world of our proliferated fantasies and thoughts and reactions. So there's something about wise mindfulness, which you know, it's sometimes called, you know, wise attention. Unwise attention is spaced out, basically, not knowing what's happening. Wise attention is that you have mindfulness. Well, mindfulness, it turns out, it tends to cut whatever chain that whatever you've been spinning out on, no matter whether it's been for a minute or days, the moment there is the knowing of what's happening, like, oh, this is what it's feeling like right now. That moment of noticing, it's like waking up from a dream. It bursts a bubble. It cuts a chain of all the links that would lead us to believe, which is what often happens in our mind. We're entranced to believe, I can't be happy now. And someone has to be different, something has to be different. It's like Oscar Wilde. I don't know. I was thinking about this yesterday. I was telling my wife when on his deathbed. What did he say? He said, this wallpaper is killing me. One of us has got to go. I just love that one. Something about wise mindfulness that protects us from unnecessary suffering, because so much of our mental suffering comes from our virtual version of ourselves, that the view of ourselves in our imagination, which is usually one that's fraught with conflict. And usually it's very hard to find conflict in real time. It almost requires our memory. So I'm talking about unnecessary conflict. I mean, there are conflicts that we have to confront. In fact, if we're present, we have the capacity to courageously meet what's happening. If I'm oblivious, I don't care. I care less. So if I have that, if I actually wake up to where I am and I experience injustice, which we're doing a lot of in the States right now, it brings forth this, I don't know about you, but I've had this kind of, on one hand, this quietness of sitting in the middle of it all, but on the other hand, this ferocious, like, mama bear, papa bear, that I will not let anybody cause someone suffering. That I will, like, I'm willing to get in front of a truck. And, you know, that, so it's not a passive, you know, everything is beautiful. I'm not saying I'm courageous, but a gift of courageous presence that I think is also intrinsic to our nature. Because it's no longer about me and mine. Another gift, the thinning of the preoccupation with my own internal drama. Would you consider that a gift? So wise mindfulness. And then I think I said before, the gift of those qualities, they're called concentration factors. I call them the love muscles. You know, the gathering and the sustaining and the intense and rapture and comfort and one-pointedness that comes when we keep gathering our attention here, that allows for us in this very life, in this very moment, a calm abiding, shamatha. What a gift to offer to ourselves and to offer to others, that gift of peace. Pleasant dwelling in this very life, as the Buddha called it. course, that's not necessarily liberation, but it is very onward leading. It actually makes possible for us to see clearly. If my mind is constantly reverberating from the effect of things I've said or did, or things I didn't say or didn't do because I was unconscious, very difficult to have this love muscle present, this sense of immediacy. And if I don't have that sense of immediacy, how can I really see what this world needs? Or how can I really see what it is in my life and in others' life causes suffering? And how can I actually effectively help? So the gift of mindfulness, of concentration, of wise effort. And then the gift, of course, if you have wise effort, wise concentration, wise mindfulness, wise action, you have the capacity then to see through the illusion of your separateness. See through the identity view. Not see everything from the sense of ourselves, but begin to relate to a sense of ourselves. To view ourselves from this wide sense of our place. Our place of interbeing. Brought along Thich Nhat Hanh's, I hope I have it here. So to me, this is wise view. You and me, you are me and I am you. Isn't it obvious that we inter are? You cultivate the flower in yourself so that I will be beautiful. I transform the garbage in myself so that you will not have to suffer. I support you, you support me. I am in this world to offer you peace. You are in this world to bring me joy. So the gift of seeing through the illusion of separateness, the gift of seeing the inevitability of the stresses that come when you're born, call it the leading cause of sickness, old age, dying. The gift of seeing the inevitability of stresses that come with being born, and instead of having a life that's constantly running from the truth of dukkha, of unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, stress, etc., giving ourselves the gift of opening to and welcoming the stresses of our life so we're not compounding them. And giving ourselves the gift of knowing that with the lessening, the loosening of our fighting with reality. I always think of the maybe I'll repeat this on the weekend, but the story that I often tell, it's anonymous, but I tell it anyway. It's called the 84 problems. No. Somebody went to the Buddha and said, what's the good of all your teachings? I'm having trouble with my wife, my kids. I like them, but they're not turning out the way I want them. I'm having trouble farming. I'm having trouble this. I'm doing that. And the Buddha said, I can't help you with these problems. He says, well, what's the good of your teachings? He says, listen, everybody has 83 problems. Some may go away and others return. He says, I can't help you with the 83 problems, but I can help you with the 84th problem. Well, what's the 84th problem? It's that we don't think we should have any problems. And that's the both obvious and very subtle ways that somehow when there is stress in our life, somehow when there is impermanence, somehow when there is sickness, when there is aging, that somehow we think we relate to it as something's wrong. And often that gets extended to the self-view, sakkaya ditti, there's something wrong with me. And then we become so deluded in our own personal view of what's wrong, and it also then starts getting projected on others that no one else is dealing with this, it's just me. When in fact, this is a universal truth. So when there's a cessation of that 84th problem, there is so much peace. So much peace that comes from understanding that we are all in this together. That we are sentient beings. And that it's not just me that will die and the time of my death be uncertain. Every one of us. Yeah. And, you know, with that cessation, there is and all the ways that we fight reality, all the ways that we're caught in a state of clinging or craving, when there is a relinquishing of that, space is there, open and inviting and comfortable. And we can then rediscover that the gift of our, you know, of our own natural freedom. So the whole Eightfold Path is about a gift to yourself and obviously a gift to others. So I had all kinds of quotes with me tonight, but I think you get the point. I think it would probably be better right now to do a little practice of giving ourselves the gift of attention and the gift of stepping out of the identity view and the conceptual version of ourselves that's playing in our mind, and just to meet ourselves directly and simply. So feel free to make any alteration to your posture to refresh it, as though you're just landing on your cushion now. I think tonight, since we're all coming off of our busy weeks, whatever you may have been doing or thinking about, that we'll just try to put our attention in the same location as our body and give our body the gift of attention. The Buddha stated, if there was one thing that leads to focus, a calm abiding, a pleasant dwelling in this very life. One thing, O monks, and you're all monks tonight, one thing is mindfulness directed to the body. So one of the ways that we can direct mindfulness to our body is to find a posture that is relaxed, upright, neck resting easily on our shoulders, our head resting easily in our neck, having our cheekbones lined up with our occipital ridges, our pelvis slightly forward, dropped, contact with our feet if you're in a chair, and our rear end, our knees and our buttocks if we're on a cushion, and perhaps even shifting side to side or front to back till you find the center point where sitting is effortless. And then let your body just melt away to a gentle stillness, like a block of ice that's been left out in the sun. And just to draw our attention a little bit more intimately, feeling the place where our rear end touches the cushion or chair, and hovering until that idea of cushion or chair melts away and there's just sensation. And feeling the touch of the hands and whatever they're touching, hovering long enough until the idea of hands melts away and there's just sensation. The same with the lips and the eyelids. Till there are no lips, no eyelids, just sensation. And then the form or the shape of the whole body, its vibration or aliveness, just feeling it so intimately until there is no body, there's just sensation. And then in the middle of that field of sensations, the gentle movements that are made by our body's breath. Or you could call it the body's experience of its own breathing. Just felt as sensation. Sometimes choppy sensation, sometimes smooth, deep, shallow, long or short. Making no effort to manipulate or change those sensations, just noticing the unfolding of the sensations of breathing. It's not uncommon for a little ego to get in there and try to control or direct, make it personal. As much as possible, just let the impersonal process of breathing occur. And try to enjoy that little ego thing. Just notice it. Oh, controlling, directing. Oh, let go. Let be. Just this breath as it is. Just this moment. Just sensation. remaining undistracted as long as it lasts. In other words, fully present, lucidly aware. But it won't last. Thoughts will come and mindfulness may not rise up to notice the thought, and you may find yourself having gotten absorbed in a fantasy. And at whatever point, mindfulness reappears, rises up again. You realize you've drifted off. This is good news. When you wake up to where you are, relax. And once again, anchor your attention to this field of sensations. The gift of awareness. Just this moment. Awareness is peaceful. Give yourself the gift of peace. Awareness has no agenda. No desire, no aversion. It just knows. Just be aware. No need to meditate. Just be aware. No need to be a meditator. Just be aware. 3 more minutes. May all beings offer themselves and each other the gift of awakening. May all beings know the natural peace and ease that is the natural peace and ease of our own hearts and minds. May all beings be liberated. May our practice be dedicated to the welfare and benefit of all. Ding. Real pleasure to sit with all of you.